We welcome you to this audio series intended to provide information to those eligible for Air Force legal assistance, which include active duty military members, their dependents, and retirees. Our hope with this series, which we are calling The Art of Law at Hill Air Force Base, is that we can convey legal assistance information to you that is readily available, provide information that is responsive to your needs, and to do so in a timely manner. This series is for information purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for legal advice from an attorney. Today we welcome John Bergstresser, one of our attorneys who provides legal assistance. John will be speaking to us today about individualized education plans and the process of obtaining one for your child. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Brad. It's a pleasure to be here today to help out on this very important topic.
So, John, I know that some of our legal assistance clients will have questions about a 504 plan as well as an IEP. Today's discussion will focus only on the IEP plan, and we'll have a future podcast on 504 plans, but both deal with accommodations. But for our audience today, can you briefly explain the difference between the two?
Yeah, so an IEP is going to focus more about specific attainable education goals in the classroom. These are very education curriculum focused, whereas the 504 provides more generalized accommodations and support to your children.
So let's get down to the basics then, John. What is an IEP? What does it stand for?
An IEP stands for an Individual Education Plan. It was codified by federal law through the Individual with Disabilities Education Act, or IDEA, back in 1990. And its purpose was to ensure that students with a disability are provided with free, appropriate public education tailored to their individual needs. And you know what?
What's that, John?
Well, I was an IEP kid myself. Now, we obviously work together, and you know this about me, but to our listeners, I have a hearing impairment, and I'm medically considered deaf. So growing up in public school, I needed to be on an IEP to ensure that my free appropriate public education was tailored to my deafness.
So you're a great person, John, to be able to discuss this based on your personal experiences as well. So let me ask you, is an IEP something that anyone with a disability can receive?
Right. So unfortunately, not everyone with a disability can get an IEP. The IDEA only permits an IEP if a child, someone beginning at the age of 3 and through their 21st year, meets any one or more of the 12 identified disabilities. And those 12 disabilities are going to be autism, deafblindness, serious emotional disturbance, hearing impairment to include deafness, an intellectual disability, multiple disabilities, orthopedic impairment, other health impairments, specific learning disabilities, speech or language impairments, traumatic brain injury, or visual impairment, which also includes blindness.
So those are very specific areas that we're talking about. So let me ask you the question, John. If someone who has a child who is 15 and has, say, for example, glaucoma, could it be an IEP eligible disability?
More than likely, it might be considered a visual impairment disability in which the child could receive an IEP and special accommodations or modification to their education. But Brad, let's talk about a disability where the answer may not be as clear, but affects a lot of kids. And I'm thinking about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. And I think this is a perfect segue into discussing the IEP process.
That sounds good. So first explain why ADHD may not be as clear.
Of course. So similar to other disabilities, experts agree that ADHD to be on a spectrum. And what that means is that each person can experience a varying level of symptom severity or have different types of ADHD. One child with ADHD may be high functioning and would not need any educational support, but another child with ADHD may not be as high functioning and could benefit from additional education support. Parents should consult with a medical professional to make those determinations. I might have a Juris Doctor, but I'm not that kind of doctor.
So what you're saying then is the severity of a disability is a factor for determining whether an IEP is appropriate.
Yes and no. The first step in the IEP process is going to be the referral. What we've discussed so far are the types of disabilities that are eligible for an IEP. When a parent, teacher, or other school professional identify the disability, they may request a referral for the child to be evaluated. Taking our ADHD example from earlier, if a child is showing symptoms of ADHD, such as inattentiveness, easily distracted, or restlessness, to name a few, a parent or a teacher may recommend that the child be evaluated for an IEP through a referral. So going back to your question, Brad, a child with high-functioning ADHD may not be referred, but a child who is low-functioning and shows more symptoms or the symptoms are impeding the child's education, then it may trigger a referral. So going back to the severity, a low-functioning child with ADHD may be more severe and it's more appropriate to refer them for an IEP evaluation.
So that's great to know. I'm sure our clients are interested to know what should be included in the referral that you're talking about. So can you explain that in greater detail?
Of course. And I would stress this is really where, as legal assistant attorney, we are going to play a critical role in assisting our clients. Because the initial evaluation has only two outcomes. Yes, your child is eligible, and the assessment is reviewed by a multidisciplinary team to determine the types of accommodations and modifications, or no, your child is not eligible. So it is very important to make sure there is sufficient information to support why a child needs an IEP. So parents should thoroughly explain what is the nature of the disability. Who does the disability impact? Not just the child, but anyone else. When does the disability occur, or how does it manifest itself? And most importantly, how does the disability impact the child's education, and how would an IEP help the child? The information contained in the referral does not need to only be just the parent's letter. It can be any documents that would support the need for an IEP, such as letters from a babysitter, a tutor, a neighbor, and yes, your child's doctor or specialist. The Code of Federal Regulation, when it comes to evaluating and interpreting the data, should draw upon a variety of sources, including aptitude and achievement tests, parent input, and teacher recommendations.
So that's very helpful to parents, but if we were to use the ADHD example from earlier that you talked about, how would this referral look like if it came from a parent? What must be included?
I'm really glad you asked that question because I was thinking the same thing. So if we go back to our ADHD example, and this time we're going to give our fictional child a name. Let's call them Alex. In Alex's referral letter, I would explain that they have ADHD. And explain that Alex has been restless and they cannot sit longer than 10 minutes. They speak out of turn when it's expected that everyone be quiet, or they have a hard time paying attention when spoken to, as if they're constantly looking around while being spoken to. They lose interest in assignments that are long-term, such as reading a book and making a shoebox diagram. The disability doesn't just affect Alex. It's also having a detrimental impact on other students around Alex. They're having a hard time focusing because of their restlessness and outspokenness. Alex's symptoms generally occur after breakfast when they're more awake and have more energy. But those symptoms tend to wind down somewhat after lunch until they go home, and then it peaks up again. As a result of this disability, it is impacting Alex's education because they are receiving low grades, they forget about an assignment, maybe how it was explained to them, or simply they just turn in incomplete assignments. An IEP that would allow Alex to complete assignment with more time, or one-on-one with a tutor or teacher, would greatly benefit Alex. An environment where they can complete the assignment with minimal distractions for let's say 1 hour a day, would also significantly help Alex. to help with his, with their restlessness, some type of under-the-desk bike pedal may help, or a different type of chair where they can bounce quietly may help. In this example, you can see how I've addressed each major point. Obviously, in a real letter, I would be much more detailed to even explain each point by subject areas, because subjects may require more or less detail. Alex might excel in classes where there's much more hands-on activity and movement, such as gym or drama, but Alex may have a much harder time in classes where there's little or no movement. I would also include a diagnosis from a specialist or a doctor, letters from neighbors, babysitters, or tutors, and even include some report cards to show how Alex does in certain classes better than others. And all of these supporting documents, I would always, always be sure to reference that in my referral letter.
I think you've summed up the referral letter quite well, and the information you shared sounds like it could help a lot of parents, a lot of our clients. Is there anything, John, anything else about the referral and evaluation process you think needs to be added?
Well, I think the one more thing that I would add is that by law, the parents must provide a written consent to the school or responsible education authority to review the data and perform the initial evaluation. Once that informed consent is signed and received, this is going to trigger the timeline process. And in Utah, that time is 45 school days to review the data and provide them with a response. Any test or evaluation must be given in the child's native language or way of communication that is likely to yield accurate information, unless it is not feasible to do so. So legal assistant eligible client should come in for an appointment to discuss more, as each child's disability is going to be unique, and each referral letter must be tailored to that unique circumstances. If not through our office, there are plenty of special education advocates out there.
Very good, John. Moving on, though, what happens after Alex's referral gets evaluated and it is determined eligible for an IEP?
Yes, so once Alex is determined eligible for an IEP, then that means they're eligible for special education and related services. Within 30 calendar days after they are determined eligible, the IEP team must meet to write an IEP for Alex.
So you refer to an IEP team, but can you explain a bit more about what that is, what they do, and actually who is a part of that team?
Yeah, so the IEP team is going to be made up of 7 required individuals, but not all 7 may be there. So let me explain. You have the parents, at least one regular education teacher, if the child is or may be participating in the regular education classroom, at least one special education teacher of the child or a special education provider of the child, a representative of the school or local education authority who is qualified to provide or supervise provisions of the IEP, knowledgeable about the general education curriculum, and knowledgeable about the availability of resources of the school and local education authority. 5th, you'll have an individual who can interpret the instructional implications of the evaluation result. 6, other individuals who have knowledge or special expertise regarding the child. And then lastly, when it is appropriate to have the child involved in the meeting. I mentioned that these 7 are required, but they may not all be there. You might ask, John, how can you require 7 individuals but not have 7? Let's look at the regular education teacher. The goal of an IEP is to provide Alex with special education, but to do so in the least restrictive environment, which would be the regular education classroom. If Alex's ADHD can be accommodated in the regular education classroom, then we need a regular education teacher in the IEP meeting. If Alex's ADHD cannot be accommodated in the regular education classroom and has to be in a special education classroom full-time, then Alex's parents and the school can agree in writing that the attendance of the teacher is not necessary because a teacher's area of the curriculum or related service is not being modified or discussed in the meeting. That consent can apply to the special education teacher, the representative, and the individual who interprets the result. Each person is going to need a consent each time. The parents and other individuals and the child cannot be excused from the IEP team. You may also see one person can cover different areas. A special education teacher or a representative may be qualified to interpret the instructional implication of the evaluation results, and therefore there is no need to bring another person into the meeting just for that. Likewise, a special education teacher or a regular education teacher may be qualified in each other's areas, so having two teachers may not be necessary either, but it is still always a good idea to have both. You may also see more than seven individuals. Sometimes an IEP accommodates or modifies multiple classes in different ways, and it is beneficial to have more than one regular education teacher, such as a mathematics teacher and a language arts teacher, if the accommodations are going to be significantly different.
Let me back up on something that you said earlier, John. You said that the child is required to attend meetings when appropriate. Can you clarify what that means?
Right. And I really should say that the child is not required to be at any IEP meetings until they are between the ages of 14 and 16, depending on the state, or if the meeting will be covering post-secondary goals and transition services needed to assist the child in obtaining those post-secondary goals. Speaking from my own experience, I started attending my own IEP meetings with my parents when I started middle school, so around 13 years old, give or take. I had a regular education teacher, a special education teacher, the principal, and a school counselor. Prior to middle school, I was not involved in any IEP meetings, even though I had an IEP beginning when I was just 3 years old. So although the child is required to be in meetings beginning at 14 to 16 years old, as determined by the state, they can still attend meetings younger than that if their contribution, understanding of their need and want would be beneficial to the discussion and the parents think it is appropriate.
It's very interesting, John, a very interesting personal perspective, and I'm sure our listeners appreciate that, so thank you. Are there any other requirements for the IEP team or meeting?
Yes, just one more thing I would like to add on to that. When there is a meeting, the school must contact all the participants and notify parents early enough to make sure they have an opportunity to attend. Schedule the meeting at a time and place agreeable to the parents and the school, and in my case, it was always at the school, to tell the parents the purpose, time, and location of the meeting and who will be attending. The school will also let the parents know that they may invite others to attend who have knowledge or specialized expertise of the child. The school will need to know in advance of any invited attendees. There's no set time required by IDEA in which parents must be informed of a meeting, only that it is early enough for them to have an opportunity to attend.
Very good. Very informative, but we should probably begin to wrap this discussion up regarding IEPs. But one last thing that I think parents really want to know in what actually is included in the IEP in the end.
I think this is a great way to tie everything up, Brad. Once everything has been discussed and even negotiated at the IEP meeting, the team will either have completed a copy that is available at the meeting or provide one to the parents within a few days. Either way, the parents should always have a copy of their child's IEP, and it must be signed. Some schools may pressure parents into signing their IEP documents at the meeting, and I would strongly discourage this. Parents should take the time to review their child's IEP and make sure they understand everything. For clients who are eligible for legal assistance, if they are not sure about something in the IEP, we can review that IEP and provide advice, explain terms and services that are being provided to their child. But to your question, Brad, the IEP in Utah, and as required by federal regulation, must contain the following information, and it is not just limited to this following information. It should contain the child's present level of academic achievement and functional performance, describing how the child is currently doing in school and how the disability affects his or her involvement and progress in the general curriculum. It should contain annual goals for the child, meaning what parents in the school's team thinks he or she can reasonably accomplish in a year. The special education and related services to be provided to the child, including any supplementary aids and services, such as a communication device, and changes to the program or support for school personnel. It should contain information on how much of the school day the child will be educated separately from children without disabilities or not participating in extracurricular activities or other non-academic activities such as lunch or clubs. How and if the child is to participate in any state and district-wide assessment, including what modifications to the test the child needs, such as a room with minimal distraction or extended time. When services and modifications will begin, how often will they be provided, where will they be provided, and how long will this last? And lastly, it should have information on how school personnel will measure the child's progress towards the annual goals. IEPs need to be reviewed either every 6 months or every year. Certain exceptional circumstances may require an IEP to be reviewed again.
This has been really great information, John. We appreciate you providing this background and this expertise that you have in this area of the law. But obviously, each child has their own unique situation and circumstances. If parents need assistance with the IEP process or wanting to get more information, they should contact our legal assistance office at area code 801-777-6626 or the Exceptional Family Member Program at the Military Family Readiness Center to get more information. They could be contacted at 801-777-4681. Thanks again, John.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be here, Brad.